Look, I'd like to start with a question about you and conducting and the way you conduct. Friends of mine who play in this orchestra come out of the Shostakovich cycle, Bluebeard's Castle, some of the Mahler, in a sort of semi-traumatized euphoria. You inject something. What's going on? What are you doing when you're conducting that?
Well, it's easier for me to explain what I felt when I was a student, while I was able to listen to some of great recordings of the past. For example, Toscanini. Even before I saw any footage showing Toscanini conducting NBC Orchestra in America or any other documentaries about him, then also Furtwängler, who, because of the results of the Second World War, in a way it was like a trophy, you know, that Soviet radio had this incredible opportunity, incredible for us, for young musicians, to air, and also even the long play recordings. You know, they had, you know, First Symphony of Beethoven, or the third, or the fifth, or the fourth, and sixth, I remember, basically all of them. Brahms, Strauss, you know, even Tchaikovsky's Sixth Symphony, Frey, Schütze. So I just remember, and before I saw any footage, in a way, you can also judge how these great, great conductors move their hands or whatever, there was a feeling that you cannot imagine the same group of musicians play like that without someone in the center leading them. It's very true about the Fourth Symphony of Brahms. In the first movement, in the end, there is this incredible movement forward, and all the forces of great Berlin Philharmonic Orchestras, they are involved in some kind of crazy, totally not calculated accelerando or stringendo or crescendo, whatever you choose. And this is about Furtwängler, because he had some kind of mysterious power which drove, if needed, this orchestral power, orchestral force, this great 100 musicians towards the ultimate goal, you know, to reach the climax and so on. And that's what made me feel that conducting is not beating the time or showing the entrances, because this Brahms was definitely not about who is entering and when the entrance should take place. It was something else. Toscanini, such a high voltage, you know, is immediately felt, that you basically don't understand how you can be so... It's not a precision, because precision becomes like obsession, because power of rhythm guarantees the precision, but precision doesn't guarantee character. Well, otherwise, metronome will be the most important instrument in the world.
These attributes that you're using to describe the great are also used to describe you. Uncalculability, if you like, or impetuosity. How does that work with you and the musicians in terms of in the moment, both during the rehearsal, but also especially on the night?
I think knowing London Symphony musicians the way I know them already gives me a lot of flexibility. For example, I know that I don't have to play all the notes all the time in order to secure a good performance. Although we all like safety, that no one on stage will have this kind of feeling of unsure, not totally prepared. You know, you don't like that, you know, yourself. And yet, by far, the most important thing is it is the character of the piece. The faceless performance, or the faceless piece of music, or faceless composer, which is the most criminal, maybe, from any conductor, to deliver this message to the public that actually the conductor is the guy who moves his hands very well. It's the composer who is a faceless person, because you just don't feel excited at all about the piece. But the truth is that most probably it's the other way around. So with LSO, we are giving a certain amount of time. Normally it's a generous amount of time to discover what is the piece. And I always try to bring most important elements to the attention of musicians. What kind of sonority should support the tempo? The choice of the tempo is, of course, a very top priority for any conductor. But you can very, very definitely mimic the tempo of the last recording you heard. And sometimes you hear great recordings. You just go like a computer, precisely repeat the same, but you can't recreate the atmosphere of a great recording because someone who made this great recording understands a lot about sonority, the sound, the timbral quality, the beauty, and also acoustics. At the Barbican, you behave differently to Musikverein, and at Musikverein, you behave differently to Carnegie Hall. I promise, it should be different. You can't apply the same trick, the same elements.
But the musicians often say that you'll do one thing in rehearsal, and then something else on the night.
Yeah, but the thing we do at the rehearsal, it is not once and forever something made of stone. The rehearsal is a preparation. The event, normally, is not a rehearsal. The event is a concert. And the concert brings concentration and very focused attention from everyone very much up. And then you have to create something what is continuation of the preparation process. But by far the most important thing is what you create in the evening.
This is very much about you and the LSO. They're now judged the fourth greatest orchestra in the world, and a lot has been written about why this is due to you. Do you have anything to say about the LSO, as it were, about the way they play apart from you? Or?
London Symphony brings immediately anything played by this great orchestra to a certain and very high level. It's up to conductor to find out how to establish atmosphere where the qualities of each musician and the quality of all together, the orchestra and each section, go into kind of unknown, that musicians sometimes don't know every piece of music so well. And together with a new piece of music comes something they maybe didn't know yesterday. You see what I mean? You
absolutely
play, okay, let's take Stravinsky. Of course, you know all these famous pieces of Stravinsky, but then you work on a certain episode in Firebird or Petrushka or even on the Symphony in Three Movements, and you can propose something and musicians will find out that they really didn't know very much about this piece, but they can play it. And once you propose something and everyone is trying how it works, and then if people see that, oh, by the way, it works very well, and there is a new color, or there is simply a new image, which is most important, images, you know, because I repeat, faceless is our enemy. Even in the most abstract pieces of music, if it doesn't have a certain vivid feeling of a certain character, look, why orchestra is on stage? Why is orchestra is not off stage? You can, of course, not only hear the orchestra on stage, you can see the orchestra on stage. And with a clarinet or horn solo or trumpet solo, normally it's very, very clear who is playing. You see the musician, and you see in the face of a musician that is expression. This is what I call not faceless, but a very, very clear image of the episode or image of the solo. And our fantasy has to be so opened and awakened that concert, a good concert, normally is full of these little discoveries. Every time an outstanding soloist can find in his solo something else which he didn't even try in the rehearsal. That normally happens. And in the best concerts, I think this is the only thing you expect to really surprise you in a positive way.
Your references to Furtwängler, Mravinsky, Toscanini, these great men knew the epic, hot, terrible things out of which you seem to suggest comes some artistic greatness. Can you talk a little bit about how you carry that into this new world, more peaceful Europe at least, world, and as a Russian, because you do so very much as a Russian?
Let me put it so. Mravinsky, one of the greatest conductors of century, or maybe of all times, also in a way was emigre in Soviet Union, because he represents Russia. He was born in Tsarist Russia. He was born in Russia, which just gave the world Igor Stravinsky, Sergei Prokofiev. Even Shostakovich was not born. Mravinsky was a couple of years older than Shostakovich. So he represented his family, you know, general in Russian Tsar's army, and his aunt was a diplomat, again, from Tsarist Russia, and she famously was in Scandinavia, and this is aristocracy and elite of a country which was destroyed by revolution. So instead of moving to Paris and drink cheap French wine and have nostalgic feelings about the country which is lost, he decided to go into the Mariinsky. He was there watching great conductors. And during the performances, he was 20 years old, 23 years old, also being a student, but then he was in the evening in the, like actors, just stand in the opera performance and you just imitate someone, like, you know, there is a king and the round king, there should be 20 people. So one of them was Mravinsky, watching Shtidri or Dranishnikov or maybe Coates, Albert Coates for sure, we know that, who was my predecessor at LSO, as you know. Coates also was my predecessor in Mariinsky. He was a music director. So Mravinsky brought these qualities all the way into 1972, when I heard him for the first time. And I started to feel immediately that I'm allowed to be quite close to a truly, truly great man, truly great personality of a time I'm living. And this is what conducting is about. He didn't move his hands very well, or at least, let me tell you, he didn't move his hands without reason at all. So for people who don't understand, he maybe looked, even then when he was 70 years old, he looked like a man who can't move. Some people would stupidly say, oh, he's an old man already. Look, he doesn't even move. Boy, but what sound of orchestra he was getting. What kind of readings. Not only Tchaikovsky and Shostakovich. I will never stop defending this. I swear, maybe the greatest Bruckner I ever heard in my life was not German orchestra and German conductor, but Mravinsky and Leningrad Philharmonic.
What about the case of Shostakovich, who had to live on so many different levels? One feels there is this sort of polemical war going on to claim him, and whether you're Volkov or whether you're the anti-Volkov or whoever you are, whether you're the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, this is all dichotomous. It all happens on so many different levels. This is what artistic life was like in the Soviet Union.
I'm not anti-Volkov, but I'm not conducting any piece of Shostakovich according to Volkov or anybody's testimony. I try to open my ears totally. And when I'm rehearsing with orchestra, when I'm looking at the score, when I'm going to conduct finally the public performance, I try to be inspired by music itself, not by the fact that someone heard Shostakovich say this and that. Because famously, Shostakovich was not very open about, so to say, what is the content, especially about his symphonies. After his opera, Lady Macbeth of Mtsensk, was hugely criticized, and he barely survived this incredible pressure on him. He decided not to compose operas anymore, which is very sad. But his symphonies continued this powerful story of his life. He was interested in the power of music reacting on everything, including beautiful and miraculously, I would say, he had his own world of dreams. What people don't understand, or at least they don't notice, that he was extremely sensitive. And if he goes into the depth of his soul, you know, where he becomes very honest with the public, and he, instead of talking, telling every musicologist, you know, this part of the symphony is about this, and then that part is about that. He would always go away from this. And he would say to me, yes, well, I don't know how to tell you. Well, you just listen. It's difficult to translate, but his words in Russian were very much like fragmented, like everything he was immediately ready to break. If there was a whole sentence, he would break it into 5-6 pieces that you can't follow his words, because he didn't want to be caught and say, okay, let's start. The beginning of symphony demonstrates this, then you see Stalin, then you see Hitler, then you see Russian forests, then you see Kremlin. Then absolutely not. And this is what for half a century people try to find there. So the real interpreters of Shostakovich music, real interpreter or interpreters, and I'm talking about string quartet or orchestra and conductor or singer or choreographer, they have to have this ability to hear his voice, hear the music. And this is what I'm trying to do with, by the way, I decided to re-record, and I'm recording now the Shostakovich cycle with Mariinsky, because I think it's terribly important also for me to use the experience I had, especially in the last 5-6 years, playing so much of his music.
In post-Soviet Russia, some very important things happen, and you liberated, in a way, a whole canon of Shostakovich's music. And I want this conversation to take us towards the subject of football, actually, because what you did with The Nose and so many of these other things that you brought into the repertoire is that one realized this was not just a one long, miserable, old, suffering, tortured man, for all that was true in one aspect. He was a man who could write wonderful film music, wonderful comedy, surrealism, and who was a fanatical football fan, which you are and so am I. Can we talk about this whole lightening up of the laughing, smoking Shostakovich?
Dmitri Shostakovich was a man full of energy, full of sharp and extremely funny words. He was, in fact, known amongst his friends as someone who comes to the party. And right away, from opening the door and entering the room full of, by the way, some of geniuses of the century, you talk about Soliartinsky, Andronikov, these are very famous people in my country, most probably Cherkasov, a great, Alexander Nevsky or Ivan the Terrible, the great, great actor, one of the greatest of the century again. And Shostakovich would enter, and even before they start to eat, he would fill his glass, but big glass, like the glass you have normally your tea, it will be like 200 grams. So you'd fill it with vodka. And just once in the entire evening, just empty it in 1 second. It was like explosion, a bam. This, not a very huge man, was able to do it. That it's 1 in 1,000 or maybe 1 in 10,000 who can do it. Shostakovich was one of them. He was never totally drunken, but he was able to shock everyone with this ability. That was his way of living, If, do it to a maximum. The football, Shostakovich was completely crazy about football. You're not talking about people who compose pessimistic symphonies all their lives and then suddenly go to the stadium and laugh and scream and jump and smoke like crazy.
Like you, a bit?
Well, I stopped smoking, at least. But well, yes, I will scream if I love the goal, or, you know.
Are you Zenit?
Not, I'm not fanatical Zenit. No. Let's say I respect artists on the field. I don't like to see machine which is so well organized that there is no way machine cannot win. Maybe we're spoiled from the times we saw Pelé, young Argentinian Maradona, Platini, Cruyff. You know, these are artists. They were different. But this, what you call a genius, when something happens on the field that you can see, God, how human being can do that, you know? It's artistry.
Do you take this love of art out of music into other areas of your personal life, cinema, book? Do you ever find yourself reading a novel, thinking, or watching a film and thinking, my goodness, you know, this is the Stravinsky of literature, or
the
Rachmaninoff of film,
yeah, when I can, I read. When I can, I read. Unfortunately, I'm under pressure to read about music more than I, let's say, I'm allowed to find out about contemporary literature. You know, this is maybe a weakness or maybe a price you pay. But theater is something very powerful. You really want to work with the people who have most incredible theatrical ideas, of course. And I'm very much part of it myself, sometimes successfully, sometimes not, but I'm interested in this very, very much. I have to say about music making, symphony and theater are very much, it's like two hands you are given naturally to operate. Why God didn't create us with three hands? You know, why the birds have two wings, correct? Even normally we are thinking of a bicycle, also two wheels, it's enough, you know? So you are very naturally placed between symphony and theater. And the most incredible compositions of all times, like Don Giovanni, or Verdi's Otello, or Queen of Spades, you know, I can continue. This will be quite a powerful list. They have so much symphony in this operatic, so much symphony. And then the Sixth Symphony of Tchaikovsky, or Eroica, it has so much about the human theater, if I may say. It's like a world's drama, you know. You immediately feel it's full of people. You are not only talking about, you know, well, you know, there is a beautiful forest there, or totally separated, or there is a beautiful lagoon, you know, a bay. So no, and people, because we normally associate drama and tragedy with whatever happens to people, many of them. And this is where you feel in the Fifth Symphony of Beethoven, or the Sixth Symphony of Tchaikovsky, or Fourth Symphony of Brahms, you feel that it's a lot said about people. The thoughts of the great composer are very much about people, and it's a symphony. Symphony doesn't tell you on the fifth page of the first movement, okay, now I'm talking about this country and that many people who suffer or who are full of joy. Of course not. It's kind of abstract, but you can't be all abstract power, you know. That doesn't excite people.
You have you've been cast, either proudly or against your will, I don't know, as a great ambassador for Russia, for the new Russia, for post-Soviet Russia. Russians love Russia in a way that no other people love their country. I mean, there's something deep and also deeply connected to music and art and literature about Russian patriotism. Does this become more important to you as the world globalizes, or less?
Russia is a country which can be wrong, leadership can be wrong, but altogether, it's a peaceful country, because after Second World War, not one person wants another war. Not one person. Russians suffered more than even Jewish people. It maybe becomes a secret, but it's Russia who lost 20 million people, plus another maybe 10 million from the Stalin years. 30, 40 million just killed. They're not dying their own life, their own death, you know. And no one wants another war. But of course, as a big country, of course, it has its own policy, its own vision for its future. And I think it will be totally, totally wrong to ignore it totally, also for the Western countries. My dream scenario is that US, Russia, Europe understand how big is their responsibility, because if these three giants, you have to add China and India, of course, but these are gigantic, historically gigantic countries, and these countries never lost importance. I mean, Europe altogether is huge, but of course, Great Britain, France play enormous role, enormous, and their individual voices have to be heard. I don't believe in collective vote for every question on the future of Europe. I personally don't believe in unanimous, like 25, all of them for it or all of them against it. It cannot happen. So you need fantastic leadership in the country, each country of those especially. I'm ready to be ambassador when I feel what I want to do is right. If I feel it's wrong, I will not move.
Mr. Gergiev, thank you very much indeed. Thank you.